Hey, while folks are coming in, if you have your laptops and you go to the SEJ agenda page, rather than leave paper handouts for you to drag around in increasing volume through the session, there are about at least 100 news stories about our topic today, fracking and finance, including the work by both panelists. So if you have a laptop and want to look at that now, you want to look at it after the session, you want to share it with friends and family or anything else, there's a lot more info there than we'll have great info in the session, but a lot more than we can cram into an hour and 15 minutes on this subject, and examples of good and bad reporting on fracking and finance. If you go to the SEJ conference agenda and go to this session on the agenda, there is a PDF file embedded in there. And, you know, we'll leave that up there pretty much forever. Whenever you want to click on it before or after, there's a lot of info in there, including Brian's series and a large part of the body of Don Hopi's work over the years on this topic. All right, Rona's here, so the party can start, right?
Woo-hoo.
Okay. My name is Peter Dykstra. I'm the publisher of two online news sites that publish original stories and aggregate news, Environmental Health News, EHN.org, and DailyClimate.org. They're all free. We have a huge archives of past stories. That's where I got the stuff we're just talking about, in addition to picking up Don and Brian's work. Let me go over the premise for this session. That's that environmental journalists generally have had some time and had some experience and had some exposure to all of the traditional environmental journalism aspects of fracking. Questions about contamination, questions about water use, questions about methane leaks, the politics that surround that, and so many other things that are closer to the traditional core of what environmental journalists do. What I'm about to say, I don't intend to say to offend any one of you. I may be saying it to offend everybody in the entire organization, but one thing we're not good at is money. We are not good at money. And we're dealing with an industry that is immense and whose financial impacts are having immense ramifications throughout the United States and throughout the world. It is a multi-billion dollar industry. And all of the implications of power, potentially of corruption, of immense benefits to communities that may be enjoying it or may be seeing some consequences from seeing their lives change quickly. A lot of what we talk about as environmental journalists actually has as its underpinnings a financial root. And we are very lucky to be joined by two people who have focused on fracking, and in a large way in Don Hopi's part, and pretty much exclusively in Brian Groh's part, focused on the money side. Don's going to go first, so let me first give you a word about Brian Groh. Brian is an enterprise correspondent for Reuters. Those of you who know me know that I came into journalism by kind of a weird route. I was the shameless propaganda minister for Greenpeace. Brian, at one point, was a government affairs executive for Coca-Cola and Philip Morris. That is not your traditional J-school route, but what it has done for Brian is, and for Reuters, has brought in a tremendous insight to the business world. And his stories have focused on that, and as they focus on that, with Brian and his investigative team, the enterprise team, they've won a lot of awards. And there was a remarkable series that's part of the collection that I mentioned on the SEJ agenda page that, among other things, won the Loeb Award as an in-depth exploration of the finances of Chesapeake Energy. Chesapeake, as many of you know, is and has been one of the biggest pioneers, both in the production sense and in the financial sense, in the fracking industry. I'll let Brian talk about the series and what happened after that series ran. But what you're going to hear is a very different take on a story that we regard generally in our work as an environmental story, and hear a lot about the financial underpinnings and hear some tricks of the trade about how Brian and his colleagues went about their work and produced some remarkable journalism. Our first speaker is someone who needs no introduction if you've been paying attention here this week, because Don Hopi is the president of SEJ. He is also a veteran correspondent of some 21 years for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and in recent years, with the Marcellus Shale Formation in Pennsylvania, it's been a big part of Don's work. If you go to that same packet of information on the SEJ agenda site, you will see something like 79 fracking-related articles by Don Hopi. Those of you who know him know that he's running a solid organization. He also does solid reporting day in and day out for a major American newspaper. So we're honored to have Brian and Don here. And, Don, I will turn it over to you to start.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I wanted to start out with one of my first, I want to read you just a couple of paragraphs from one of my first fracking stories. This is back in July 2008. And see if you can figure out what the differences are. I'm going to tell you when I'm done, but it'll just take me a minute here. On the outskirts of Katanning along the Allegheny River, well drillers mixed 1 million gallons of water and 800,000 pounds of sand and chemicals, pumped it at high pressure more than a mile underground. Their goal was to crack up a deep layer of black shale and release what they hoped to be a natural gas bonanza. The new $750,000 Snyder Brothers Oil and Gas Company test well is the first attempt by the Katanning-based company to tap the deep and potentially lucrative Marcellus Shale geologic formation, which stretches in a thick underground layer from New York to West Virginia and may hold as much as 516 trillion cubic feet of gas, about a tenth of it recoverable using modern technology. Now, what's changed here? Well, first of all, Snyder Brothers. Anybody here that's not from Pennsylvania heard of Snyder Brothers? Because Snyder Brothers is a local company. They had done a lot of river dredging, and they were getting into the gas biz. And it's not Chesapeake, it's not Shell, it's not Range. These were small companies that started this. So we don't see that much anymore. Secondly, I was walking around that day on an active frack site with a bunch of other journalists that were invited to come on the site, and we were given hard hats and goggles, and we got to walk around as they were fracking, and they were very open describing the process. Third, we walked across the road, and they had a tent set up for us, and they offered journalists cookies and soda, and they were really selling this hard, okay? And fourth, we were shepherded around by a local PR guy, Dan LaGiovanni, who was a former newspaper guy who had represented the company in river dredging media stories for the media. And you don't see him around anymore either. Okay, so it's a big, big change that we've gone through in recent years in Pennsylvania, and that's something that, as journalists, you really need to understand the way that shale plays in your regions change over time, and who the participants are, and how they react with the media. But let's pretend we're accountants and count some of the ways that they do this kind of spend some money in the Marcellus Shale play in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. That's basically what I cover, and I think there's some things here that, as journalists, we need to be alert to. First, we'll start with the political contributions. That's the obvious stuff. I'm going to use specific examples here, so I apologize in advance for reading some of these. I want to be accurate on some of the money stuff. According to the National Institute on Money and State Politics, between 2010-2012, individual GOP politicians and political action committees in Pennsylvania received $4.5 million from the gas industry. The Democrats received $650,000 during that same time. The other money went to the Republicans. Pennsylvania's Governor Tom Corbett in 2010 received more than $2.7 million from gas-related interests, about 10% of his total campaign budget. Aubrey McClendon was provided a big chunk of that, and you'll probably hear something about that a little bit later. The governor appointed a 14-member shale gas advisory commission, which provided advice on shale gas policy going forward. The members of that commission, 14 of them, contributed $442,000 to Corbett's campaigns for both Attorney General and then later as governor. All of those people were either current or former oil and gas executives or lobbyists or the wives or spouses of those lobbyists and executives. State legislators also got some of the money, mostly Republicans. Here, another almost $1 million in 2010, including $148,000 to State Senate Republican leader Joe Scarnati, who wasn't running at the time, but whose caucus blocked action on a severance tax on oil and gas money in gas drilling in Pennsylvania. It's not limited to Pennsylvania, of course. West Virginia, Antero Resources, a Colorado-based energy company, with plans to build an 80-mile pipeline to take water out of the Ohio River and pump it to their oil and gas sites. They haven't had that approved yet, but right now they're starting to contribute money to the current candidates for governor in West Virginia. They're up to $27,000 and counting. Money also pays for the revolving door between industry and government, something that you need to look at. In Pennsylvania, believe it or not, that revolving door moved to 45 current and former state officials who have links to the energy and energy industry into government positions or government positions that were hired by people that were hired by industry after their time in the state. So that whole revolving door thing is really interesting. I'll tell you one little story. At one point, I was being hollered at by the DEP spokesperson for not picking up on the spin he wanted me to report on about a particular Marcellus Shale story. That was Friday of 1 week. On Monday, he had taken a job with the Marcellus Shale Coalition, an industry group, and he called me to holler about not reporting the issue on the same issue on the way that they would like to see done. So, yeah, it happens pretty quick. Advertising is another area that's pretty commonly known. There are billboards along the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Newspapers take some advertising. Television gets a lot, and so does radio. And so do venue sponsorships. We have the Consol Energy Center where the Penguins play. There's also Consol Energy Park down in Washington County where the Washington Wild Things, an independent baseball league team, Frontier League team, plays. One of the biggest radio stations in Pennsylvania, KDKA, has reports, quote, direct from KDKA's Range Resources Studios. And they also have one of their news people hosting the Marcellus Shale Hour, a weekly show in which they discuss objectively issues of the oil and gas industry in the state. A number of festivals they sponsor, documentary films, of course, very, very aggressive funding apparatus for public outreach. Lots of advertising on TV. Range Resources, the biggest driller in southwestern Pennsylvania, does a lot of advertising. Their advertising is very homey, very flag-wrapped, very honey-sweet. Basically, if you're against Range Resources, you're against America and God and country and everything else. Their motto right now is drilling is only the beginning. Of course, the activists have adapted that to spilling is only the beginning. That hasn't deterred them at all. Some interesting kind of more minor things that you might want to look for: water testing labs. I did a story recently about three Washington County families who sued Range Resources and two water testing labs, claiming they conspired to produce fraudulent water test results and reports that this misrepresented the family's well water as good, allowing them to continue using well water that was actually contaminated. That's still in the courts, it was a situation where the water labs weren't giving full test results, something to really, really look at. They were only reporting part of the results of their tests and didn't give the full results. So a number of public water supplies, another area, public water suppliers and sewage treatment plants also making money off of Marcellus Shell gas companies for treating wastewater. The treatment of this wastewater is essentially diluting the wastewater because there was no way for them to take the salt out of this very briny and salty wastewater. The one really interesting and I think very good and small D democratic way that money gets spent is the municipal revivals that we're seeing at various places in rural Pennsylvania. Farmers, individual farmers, farm communities, small towns are all booming in throughout Pennsylvania due to things like grocery stores are getting more use, motels, lumber yards. The guy that sells Ford trucks down at the corner at the dealership, there's tons of trucks being bought there right now. Places like Williamsport, Pennsylvania, probably best known as the Little League World Series is now on the list of one of the ten fastest growing small towns in America. In the last probably century, it's been one of the sleepiest towns in the U.S. Academics, another issue that we're seeing money spent in. Right now, actually next week, October 7th and 8th, I'll be going up to Indiana University of Pennsylvania, my alma mater, look at a seminar that will present a program, Engaging Shale Gas Community Partners is the title, a workshop to understand the Marcellus shale industry. It's being put on by the university. The panelists are 80% shale gas company reps, and invited guests are the public, but also public officials who are, it's $325 to attend, but for public officials only, there's a $200 stipend available from the president's discretionary fund, the president of IUP University. That fund, we haven't been able to get access to it, but we believe that they've been getting some contributions from the oil and gas industry. They have money and they have attorneys, and they're not afraid to use them. They are used to appeal regulations, to enforce and appeal enforcement actions, and lower court decisions. They try to block a number of the efforts of the environmental groups. Quick story. I was, for last year's conference, going to Lubbock, flew from Pittsburgh to Houston and Houston to Lubbock. As I was getting on the plane in Houston, walking through the first-class cabin, I saw a friend of mine, an old friend of mine, who I used to go fishing with but haven't for the last probably decade, and he's an attorney. And he was sitting in the first-class cabin along with his other attorney friends, all of them attorneys representing the oil and gas industry, all on a flight to Houston that day. And he yelled, "Hey, Don!" And then it was almost as though his other hand, I didn't see the other hand actually grab his hand, but he pulled it down real quick, and then he kind of buried his head like that. And his buddies were all looking around like, "Who's that? How do you know that guy?" Yeah. I'm sure they knew before the flight was over. There's a lot of that going on. I'll mention just a couple more things. The They also use these, attorneys are also used to write proposed legislation. Right now there's a bill in front of the assembly that's been introduced to make it harder to list and to protect endangered species in Pennsylvania and easier to identify the sites where these endangered species exist. That would make it easier, of course, to cite Marcellus shale gas wells because they wouldn't have to be worried about where these endangered species are actually residing. And it's estimated that this would cost, because of this legislation would violate some federal rules about endangered species protection, that it would cost the state of Pennsylvania about $27 million a year in lost federal government grants. These bills have been introduced by Representative Jeff Pyle, from a Republican from Armstrong County, and Senator Joe Scarnati, a Republican from Jefferson County. Pyle has received $48,000 from oil and gas interests. Scarnati, $359,000 from those same interests. The other thing that I wanted to mention, massive public relations spokespersons' budgets. I wouldn't be surprised if some of them were here today, quite frankly. Energy in depth, energy from shale, the Marcellus shale coalitions all have very, very large staffs, much larger actually than the State Department of Environmental Protection right now. They are not particularly responsive to questions. It's a very high-stakes game for them. I feel that they attempt to intimidate reporters. I've heard from other reporters that cover this. I know for a fact that when I call them, it's not uncommon for them to respond not only to me via email, but copy to my editors above me. They get phone calls as a result of my story without calling me first. They go right to my editors. One of them actually called an editor recently and complained about the tone of my story that hadn't been published yet. He was complaining about the tone of my story based on the tone of my questions. So I guess, what's the best strategy to deal with this? As always, the thing to do is you got to know more about the subject, the well site, the enforcement action, and the water test results than they do before you make the call. Know the science, know the technology, know the history of the site before you make the call, because you're not going to get the full answer from them. You got to do a lot of legwork, and don't rely on, at least in Pennsylvania, government agencies to help. Thanks.
Thank you, Don. Some of you are in nonprofit journalism, like I am. We have to file 990s, and our information is pretty transparent. And one of the challenges here is that that's not always the case. Brian Groh is part of a team that did a remarkable effort to look at the finances of Chesapeake Energy. And Don mentioned its Consol Energy Arena in Pittsburgh. What's the name of the arena in Oklahoma City?
The Peak. Chesapeake Energy Arena.
Brian's going to take us through the work that they did with their award-winning series, how it's done, and share a few tricks of the trade that are not common to environmental journalists that may come in handy to you if you're reporting on fracking on a mega scale or even on a smaller scale in small communities.
Thanks, Peter. Hey, everybody. My name is Brian Groh. I'm an investigative reporter at Reuters. And I'm going to do a very swift and condensed version of this presentation that I actually just did yesterday in New York for an hour. And we can ask lots of questions later. You know, in a nutshell, what we did here was follow the fracking money of the self-professed world's biggest fracker, Aubrey McClendon. So this is a kind of microcosm of everything that Don was just talking about, and I'm going to show you a few things that as environmental reporters you may not do on a regular basis, but I think are incredibly powerful in terms of revealing data that can be useful to your stories and how the companies operate. And by that I specifically mean land records. In fact, we have another investigation that I did with a colleague coming out on Monday, and it involves the review of land records in 25 states at the county level. And what you'll see next week is we've been able to find how one particular group of businesses are severing the mineral rights under individual properties and keeping them for themselves, and the surface owners don't know. The point being, fracking can happen anywhere because these parties are then flipping those mineral rights to drilling companies. We actually call this story coming next week Frack My Crib, because it's about residential properties where you and I don't own our minerals and we don't necessarily know it. But in the Chesapeake series, we basically mined SEC filings and property records all around the country to basically follow Aubrey McClendon's and Chesapeake's cash. And the origins of the story you might find kind of interesting because they began with a piece that I wrote in 2011 as part of another investigative series called Shell Games. And that series was about the easy availability, uses, and abuses of U.S. shell companies at a time when the U.S. was telling the rest of the world to clean up its act. And the reason we got into this related to Chesapeake was they have hundreds upon hundreds of LLCs that they use to acquire land when they go into a new shale play. And they do it to hide their identity so that prices don't spike. And they did this in Michigan in 2010, and they paid millions and millions of dollars to acquire acreage up there. But then after drilling their first well, and we actually got emails in which Aubrey McClendon said, "We drilled a dry hole. Let's get the hell out of here." They canceled all those leases. But they used the shell company that they had formed to acquire the property as a legal defense in the lawsuits that ensued. And so we tracked SEC filings to try to establish the ownership chain of the particular LLC that Chesapeake used to acquire the land and then again used as its legal defense to say we didn't do business in the state of Michigan. In fact, they did say, amazingly, in their initial response to the lawsuits, we did not do business in the state of Michigan. It was this entity. Well, we established through SEC filings the daisy chain of ownership, and this particular document, for example, is an amendment to a bond issue where they're adding new subsidiary guarantors to the bonds 6 months after the lawsuits were filed in February 2011. And the particular entity that held the leases in Michigan was called Northern Michigan Exploration LLC. And here you can see they're adding it to their bonds. And then Aubrey even signed the document at the bottom there saying, "I'm chief executive of Northern Michigan Exploration." And we were able to establish how they were able to effectively deny that they, Chesapeake, controlled it. They introduced another company, LA Land Acquisition, as the sole member of Northern Michigan Exploration. In other words, there was a layer between them, and LA Land was a Delaware company. So in the story, we did a graphic that basically showed how Michigan landowners who were visited by a landman brokerage called Western Land Services.
And, excuse me, but everybody knows what a landman is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and I'm sure you guys do. I mean, in fact, this is, you know, a key area of opportunity for environmental journalists is to sort of track how the landmen are operating and the leases that they're signing in the land records. And I'm going to show you how to do that in a minute. But basically, the landowners leased to representatives of Western Land Services. Western Land Services had been hired by another middleman brokerage called OIL Niagara. OIL Niagara transferred the leases that it got from the Michigan landowners into Northern Michigan Exploration. Northern Michigan Exploration was controlled by the Delaware company LA Land Acquisition, and through that SEC filing, we were able to then, you know, definitively state LA Land is controlled by Chesapeake Energy. So the whole idea here, right, is to obscure the money trail, to make it difficult to follow the path, and that's what we set out to do in this particular story. But here's the great part. In the course of the investigation, a source gave us hundreds of internal Chesapeake emails, which is a gold mine, as you guys would imagine. It's them talking about their operations in their own words. And one of the emails was from a representative in Oklahoma City to a Chesapeake representative in Michigan regarding Michigan entity. And they said, hey, FYI, Northern Michigan Exploration Company was the buyer on the OIL energy deal. I don't see it in our subsidiary list. Should I use company number 337 in the meantime? Oh, by the way, Winter Moon is company number 142. Okay, light bulb goes off because we say, all right, just what do all of these companies do? There's at least 337 of them, right? And what does it mean? What does it mean in terms of how Chesapeake operates? So we started piecing things together. That email indicated the company had at least 337 LLCs that it used to buy land or do other things, right? Then we also knew through one of my teammates that Aubrey McClendon himself had his own LLCs. And the reason we knew that was because for the first time ever in 2011, they disclosed that Aubrey's Chesapeake Investments, Larchmont Resources, and Jamestown Resources were parties to a transaction in which Chesapeake sold land in the Fayetteville Shale in Arkansas to BHP Billiton for $4.75 billion. He was piggybacking on the deal, right, through his LLCs. Why was he piggybacking on the deal? Well, you guys may know or recall that Aubrey had a special perk. In fact, he still does. It lasts until July 2014. He gets 2.5% of every well the company drills, and Chesapeake's the biggest driller of wells in America. So he was parking those interests in these LLCs. And in this particular transaction, he was piggybacking on the company's sale to get his 2.5% cut. That's why they didn't say how much he got, by the way. They only said those entities participated in the transaction. So we did this story, my partner Anna Driver, which was basically about how the CEO is piggybacking on Chesapeake's deals. But then Anna and I put our heads together and said, so you know about this, the CEO's LLCs. I know about the broader universe of LLCs. What do we think this means? Well, you guys may remember that Chesapeake was this very aggressive, and still is to an extent, but it's a different approach under the new CEO. Very aggressive, very swashbuckling company, right? And it had a huge cash flow deficit. Still does, $13 billion. And nobody could really figure out how the money flowed inside Chesapeake. So there was a lot of market chatter that suggested Chesapeake might be the next Enron. You know, they had off-balance, and then what had we just found? They have off-balance sheet LLCs, right? The CEO has his own. Could this really be the way that these LLCs are being used, and is this the next Enron? That was our hunch. That's what began the investigation. We had no idea what we would actually find. But that led to the first story. And this is where I'm going to jump out for a second. And the first story in the series was called The Energy Billionaire's Shrouded Loans. Well, to summarize real quick, we found in county property records around the country that Aubrey McClendon, through those LLCs, had borrowed $1.1 billion from an investor in Chesapeake to finance that 2.5% well interest where he had to cover the costs. So why does it matter? Well, major conflict of interest possibility because he's borrowing a huge amount of money from an investor in the company who, by the way, Wall Street had already said got a sweet deal. They were offered a cut of the Utica, of a particular entity in the Utica, and they had a guaranteed 7% annual return. Guaranteed. Now I'm going to jump out here because the way we found these loan documents was to follow the trail of those LLCs. Now, Anna and I, when we said, how do we embark on this investigation, what's the path of least resistance? And as Don said, you know, there's all sorts of ways that the companies want to obscure your effort to get to the bottom of something. So we were we asked ourselves, what's the path of least resistance? And we thought, let's follow the CEO's LLCs. And so we started off with your basic Google search, where we would put Jamestown Resources in quotation marks and then see what we got. And what we found in our initial set of searches was the company, those entities showed up in property record summaries in local newspapers, for example, in Sabine and Bossier Parish, Louisiana. And so we're like, okay, why would that be? Well, it seemed that it was because as a party to a land transaction where the leased property where the well is drilled and he has 2.5% of all of it occurs, he has to file in local records that he has that ownership interest, right? So there's a paper trail, and it's a public record. So we started to call up the county clerks, and we got lucky one day when the county clerk in Bossier Parish, Louisiana, sent me a 40-page document, and the 40th page of that document was a $500 million mortgage on Mr. McClendon's well interests from EIG, Global Energy Partners, the investor in the company. We didn't know all of this at the time, right? We figured $500 million is a big number. We're on to something. Then we realized, wait a minute, that's also an investor in the company. And we decided if there's one mortgage out there, there must be more. And here's where I wanted to jump out for a second, just explain what a gold mine county property records can be. And many of you probably know it's a kind of crapshoot to be able to get these records because some county clerk records are online and free and you can get all the way to the deeds. Some are online and free, but you can only get to a summary and then you have to call up and get the actual document. Some aren't even online and you got to go in and order it from the clerk. But by and large, you can get it with enough effort. This is one of the most sophisticated county clerk record databases that I've found, and we use it all the time now. And this is Oklahoma County, home of Chesapeake, and they have a search engine loaded on top of their recorder of deed records, which is that rod search up in the top left corner. And if I do Jamestown Resources in the database, check this out. Too bad the local newspapers didn't realize what they had sitting right underneath them out there. There's Aubrey McClendon's mortgages right there in the middle. Do you see that? Jamestown Resources EIG Management Mortgage. The same records were filed in Oklahoma County because he had borrowed against all of his well interests and some of them were out there in that county. But this database has a record of every transaction that has been done by his corporate LLCs. You could piece together everything, and anybody could have done it before we did it last year. These types of websites are increasingly available. And in fact, in the story I mentioned called Frack My Crib, we went into these databases in 25 states where we knew that these certain parties might be severing mineral rights, and we knew the names of the entities that they might be using. We did the same thing. And then we downloaded all the records, and then we called the surface owners and said, hey, there's this document filed in county court. It says you don't know your minerals. Did you know that? Almost every time, it was a WTF moment where they said, one guy said, wait a minute, let me sit down. I don't own the minerals on my land? No, and so, I mean, then there was repercussions, right? And that was the point of the investigation. Let me show you something else really interesting. So this is the UCC search, and you guys may know that the UCC is a document filed by a creditor to record formally a debt, right? And so if you're following the fracking money, debts are a good way to kind of figure out what they owe and to whom. It's not always recorded, but it's often recorded. And this is a gold mine, too, for the local newspaper if they had followed it, but they didn't do that before we did. In here, if you run Aubrey McClendon, you can get all of Aubrey's debts that have been recorded out there in Oklahoma County. Let me show you a great one. So he's in hock to Goldman Sachs, Dear Credit, George Kaiser. You guys may know George Kaiser is a big energy baron out in Oklahoma City and has been something of the bailout king for other troubled energy barons out in Oklahoma City. He lent money to Aubrey, where Aubrey pawned his oil and gas, historical paraphernalia, for a loan.
And those are individuals, not corporate entities
that
they control.
Well, exactly. So in this case, George filed a UCC. He doesn't, I mean, it's unusual, right? But that's the point. It's a big discovery. But what I wanted to show you was this guy right here from Goldman. Where is the Goldman one? There it is. Oh, no, sorry. It's on the next page. Yeah. There we go. We're going to open the document. So this is a Goldman debt. You know, you want to talk about a story telling itself. Here, when this loads, I don't know if we can see it enlarged. Okay. Well, that list, folks, I'm sorry it's so tiny, is 2,000 bottles of wine owned by Aubrey McClendon that he borrowed against via a loan from Goldman Sachs because he was short on cash, right? Because he's trying to pay for all those well interests. But, you know, you want to talk about a colorful story. There are Chateau Lafites and stuff in here. I mean, he at one point had cornered the Bordeaux market. So it's just it's really good color. And sometimes you get these great finds in these county property records. So I just would encourage you to use it as a tool in your arsenal. Because it's a soft spot, too, right? It's a public record. They don't like these records to be out there. But they have to. So
if there are federal records, there's no need to worry because the government's shut down.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Or you have to file FOIA that will come back in about 3 years.
Right.
So that was the first story. Look, what we found was he was borrowing against his well interests as Chesapeake drilled more wells. Aubrey needed more money to cover his cost of his share of those wells. So he borrowed more and more and more over time. Now, what we did, by the way, was we compared it to what they disclosed to their investors. So context here, and I'll cut this off. The stock dropped 10% the morning this story came out. The company had fought us tooth and nail, saying we weren't under any obligation, but in any event, we did disclose, but they hadn't said that he borrowed $1 billion from an investor in the company, et cetera, right? But they fought us tooth and nail. They even posted our Q&A on their website, which spawned more stories that were bad for them. It's a big PR blunder. But clearly, investors cared and found this to be material. That's why the stock tanked and Aubrey stepped down as chairman the next week. But one of the things we wanted to find out in our analysis was what had they actually told investors and how did they basically justify not disclosing everything that we found in the county property records. Well, one of the things was they had this chart about the estimated value of his well interests, right? And it showed massive losses every year. It was like, why would you do this if you were losing so much money? But actually, he wasn't losing any money because he had borrowed it. And the first sentence after this chart says, the foregoing information has been derived solely from the company's records. That was a big out because the company's position was these were his personal transactions. Therefore, it didn't have any records, quote unquote, technically, about his loans, even though they were out there in public records as well. So just a little technical out. Also, we looked at every instance in which they discussed whether he could finance his well interests. They did, but in very obscure ways. So in a section of the proxy called engineering support, where you would be presumably reading about engineering support, they actually say he has done personal financing transactions. But that's all they said. I'm going to skip forward. So, you know, we went to Wall Street analysts and we said, hey, look, we found these loan documents, and then here's what the SEC filings say. And then one of the leading analysts basically said, given what you've just told me, those disclosures are meaningless. They don't tell me much. We then followed on that story, by the way, with another investigation showing that Aubrey had operated a $200 million hedge fund from company headquarters trading in oil and gas for his personal benefit, where he was a market maker. How did we find that? Well, you guys may recall that Congressman Bernie Sanders had leaked some CFTC trading records showing that Aubrey McClendon had the second largest personal position in oil and gas in 2008. And after we did the first loan story, we thought, hey, let's figure out exactly how that happened. And we had a person, one of my colleagues had a source at the CFTC who told her the name and address of the entity that did Aubrey's trades. It was called Heritage Capital Management, and it was located at 6100 Northwestern Avenue, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And when she came to me with that information and she read it to me, I said, that's Chesapeake headquarters. So, red flag, right? Hedge fund with an address same as Chesapeake. Major conflict of interest issue. That became this story. One of the things we did was look at his employment agreements, and it's gobbledygook. But the reason it's up here is when we read it and we had independent experts read the employment agreement too, basically you can't tell whether it was illegal to run a hedge fund from headquarters trading in oil and gas or not, right? Because there were all sorts of little technicalities that could or could not be possible. For example, except for passive investments that do not violate this agreement and require only a minimal portion of the executive's time, serve as a general partner or member of any corporation, partnership, company, or firm. Well, he was the general partner of the hedge fund. But guess what? He had a head trader who did all the trading. So it could have been passive and didn't require much of his time. So lots of outs. We then did a story called The Lavish and Leveraged Life of Aubrey McClendon, where we followed those debts in the UCC records to show how he had hawked everything from his wine collection to his oil and gas memorabilia to even he had borrowed against his 20% interest in the Oklahoma City Thunder for extra cash from Bank of America and Wells Fargo. And then we also got internal records showing that those engineers, accountants, and others had provided him with $3 million worth of personal work for his oil and gas interests. But the company...
Lest you not all be NBA fans, the Oklahoma City Thunder is basketball team.
It's the basketball team.
And if any of you are from Seattle, you know that that's where the team was kind of stolen.
Yeah. So, you know, the irony being, right, he's a 20% owner of the local NBA team, but he's actually used his 20% interest to generate more cash for himself. Point here was... We also looked at their proxy filings to see if that $3 million was what they had disclosed to investors that the company had spent on Aubrey's personal needs. It wasn't. What they disclosed was $1.3 million in all other comp for that year and then another $375,000 in accounting and other services. That doesn't add up to $3 million. Then we did seven stories, but this is the other big one that had some impact. There's an ongoing Department of Justice antitrust investigation right now, and it brings me full circle back to the importance of tracking land records on the oil and gas companies. Here we got several hundred internal emails showing Aubrey talking to the president of Encana. You guys probably know about Encana, big Canadian oil and gas company. And in the emails, Aubrey says, it's time to smoke the peace pipe before pushing the price up on the land. And he got his deputy to get in touch with Encana, and they agreed to divide up 9 counties and 10 private landowners between them for bidding purposes when they went in to lease the acreage. So that they would, and they openly talked about keeping the price down. This is market allocation under the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Is there private litigation on that, too?
So there's two ongoing lawsuits by private landowners who were named in the emails as being divvied up. And then there is a Michigan Attorney General and Department of Justice ongoing investigation. But, you know, just my point on mining SEC filings, after our story came out and the investigations were commenced, The company in its 10Q acknowledged that, but then it added some interesting things. It said the company's received demands for documents and information from state governmental agencies, plural. Well, at this time, by the way, we only knew about one state governmental agency. So we don't even know to this day who else might have been investigating. But these are the sort of little reveals that if you read really close and you cross-reference with other known data, can be pretty powerful in terms of investigating things. I just wanted to add something to what Don said about the money flows and some of the interesting story opportunities and ways to mine it. I don't know if you know, down there's a small town, I can't remember the name, in West Virginia on the Ohio River. And Chesapeake is the driller in the area. And Chesapeake, through its community relations department, which is vast and has a lot of cash, had promised to buy new band instruments for the middle school in town. And then when the town decided to pass a urban drilling ban, Chesapeake pulled the donation for the tuba players and the trumpet players, saying, we're not going to give you money if you're not going to do what we want. What's my point? We looked into this pretty closely, and we did a national analysis. We never did a story. Quid pro quos on community benefits because we're part of your community are a great story, right? They are also, I think, a very common thing that underlies everything about the community relations. Why do I say that? I come from the dark side, as some of my more Puritan colleagues say. I was a corporate flack and lobbyist. I've been in the room where there's a discussion of what the expected outcome of our community relations activities will be. You know, mine it. I mean, you know, it's very, very good for following the fracking money flow.
Sponsor a Little League team and throw a pizza party and yep. Open the door to $1 million worth of drilling.
But the way to mine it right is to make sure to get to the people and ask about the conversations they've had about what was expected, you know, in return for the Little League sponsorship and the pizza party. Or even if it wasn't stated directly, what was implied? What did they hope the outcome would be?
Well, the political contributions that you see on the state and you know, state legislative level, you can also trace those down to the local levels. It's amazing what $5,000 or $10,000 will buy in a local election in a township where there are only 10,000 people or something. It's a real influence for a lot less than you would expect.
Absolutely. We actually did a database analysis of all Chesapeake contributions to Ohio state local and state legislators. It wasn't revealing enough to merit the story, but it was very interesting because they flowed clearly to places where they had established a land position. That was the overlay. We looked at their leasing, and we looked at where they gave money.
And I think the moral of the story of what you're hearing is that a lot of this data is out there, and the money trail is there. It may take some work, and it may take some skill to find it. In some jurisdictions, they may not make it easy to find. But it's, as Brian said and as Don said, it's there. I've got a lot of questions for these guys, but in the time we have left, I want to yield to your questions. I'll throw out a couple other things. Money goes in all directions in fracking. If you look at the packet of stories that I put on the agenda, there are several about the Park Foundation, which is the biggest philanthropy funding fracking opponents. You may want to take a look at that. And by way of full disclosure, you know who else takes fracking money, although not quite on the scale that we're talking about here? The Society of Environmental Journalists sells ads to any entity, provided it's not hate speech or libel or anything else. And there have been fracking ads in the SE Journal, and we've heard from some fracking opponents who feel that that is in its own way a compromise. I don't want to make that the focus of the discussion, but if you have a question of that, send me that question, and I will bail and send you to the president of SEJ. But let's hear your questions. For those of you who are new, there are a couple of rules that SEJ has. Journalists and SEJ members first for questions. Identify yourself, and we'll take it from there. And it is questions, not speeches. We may have a philanthropist or two in the room, and your question cannot be in the form of a grant proposal. So who wants to go first? Yes.
Janet Donahue, WDBX. I'm in Southern Illinois, which is, we're going through a lot of fragment stuff. I've been talking about a year and a half now. I do a weekly environmental radio program. I'm wondering if you have experienced as well with the donations for politicians. We have some that we feel definitely been purchased. If you have found a similar scenario with covering the tracks of that funding, you know, you can't necessarily lead it right back to the company, and how you dealt with that, if at all.
Yes and no. So, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot as to what the disclosure laws and public document availability is in the particular jurisdiction that you might be looking at. That's my experience. Just like with land records, you just never know. Is there an effort to obscure money trail in political donations? Absolutely. So, you know, the best one is to form the coalition that is funded by particular entities. Then you flow the money into the coalition, and then the coalition makes the donation, and where exactly it came from is not necessarily clear. You know, I think one of the things about McClendon, at least, is that he was so bold and swashbuckling that he put so much in his own name that you could follow the trail that much more easily. But Chesapeake as a whole has used the coalition strategy, as have many others. So I'd encourage you to follow it very aggressively because, I mean, it tells the story if you can do the TikTok. And then obviously you always want to, I think, build the timeline against the money flow, right? So here's the dates of the money flows. What happened around these dates? You know, and not necessarily like day after, you know, over a longer period, because then the story is even more powerful. Because then when you go for comment, right, sir, you took X on Y amount on Y date. 3 weeks later, this document indicates you voted this way for this thing. So, you know, tell us, how did this happen? What happened here? You know.
Just a quick add. You also have to be aware of relationships. Sometimes the money doesn't come from the companies or individuals that are presidents or CEOs of the company, but can come from spouses, can come from their children who suddenly have an interest in politics. So if you don't know those names, or if you see strange names on your search findings, it's worth it to make a couple of other clicks to find out who they really are and what their relationship is.
And if you're looking at the federal level rather than local level, the Citizens United court decision a few years ago changed the game on that and kind of opened the floodgates. Rona.
Yes, hi. I'm Rona Flamel. I wrote for the Chesapeake Bay Journal on us. Monthly radio show. We have a lot of traffic because a bunch of them are shells, shells in our watershed. And I guess I'm wondering kind of two things. Did Aubrey McClendon himself ever talk to you? And did you experience any backlash? John talked about this a little bit, and I've experienced it myself, from the energy and depth slaps and other people personally attacking you and your work, either before or after the publication.
So Aubrey refused to talk. He responded to an email I sent him on the first day. I sent him directly an email. No flax, no nothing. And he responded. That's actually in the story, but it was shut down thereafter. We asked for an interview. We wanted to sit down and go soup to nuts. We really did. We wanted to say, tell us about this document, about this document. And we asked for an interview across every one of the seven stories. The company went into a bunker, right? I mean, what was the fallout ultimately? Aubrey lost his job. The entire board was wiped out. There's a new management leadership right now. 55 of 65 of the PR department were fired 2 weeks ago. There's a new spokesperson. This was partly to do with it, but it was also performance right of the company that finally this series probably put investors over the top, and they said, we're going to take over the company. That's what happened. But in terms of talking to us, no. They actually just reached out to us for the first time in a year and a half last week. And it was kind of nice. In terms of hostility, you know what they were the most upset about in the first story, which was basically the only time they were really responding, was that in the lead of the story we talked about how at Chesapeake headquarters you could get free Botox treatment at the health clinic. And that was their only complaint after the story came out. And we're like, really?
It wasn't free?
No, it was completely true. They just thought it was improper to emphasize that you could get Botox on campus. We were like, hell no, this is exactly a point about the culture of the company. My editors were laughing. They're like, really? So no hostility. They did post our answers, our questions, and their answers. I think I mentioned that on their website. I'd never had that before, right? It was like an attempt to shame us or something. Mm-hmm. What happened was it spawned about a dozen more stories by bloggers and others saying, look at the ridiculous legalese the company used in its responses to Reuters. So it was a very curious strategy. Now, what we have gotten criticized for is, I don't know if you guys have read it, but we, after the Chesapeake series, we then started looking at Sandridge Energy, and their CEO got thrown out in June. And then we looked at Harold Hamm and Continental and his divorce, which stands to be the biggest divorce in world history.
He's the big North Dakota guy.
He's another big fracker, right? By the way, he and Aubrey are the main characters in Greg Zuckerman, a Wall Street Journal reporter's upcoming book, The Frackers. It comes out November 5th. And then just recently I did a piece on Gulfport Energy and millions of dollars in equity stakes given to the chairman of the company by a hedge fund that he did deals with. My point being, we've been criticized for picking on Oklahoma City companies. But they seem to do a lot of squirrely stuff, and we don't know why. But, you know, so.
Allison?
Have you seen...
And give us your full name. I only gave half of it.
Allison Jones. I come from New York. I'm director of No Water, No Life. I left Lubbock last year after SCJ and wandering along the Red River, and a B&B owner said to me, you know about the fracking here? So he sent me on some leads, some citizen groups. They told me that, yes, the land acquisition had been filed in the paper and the public records, but oops, wrong county. And EIG was really so sorry that they got the county. Have you seen evidence of filings going into a different county? Oh, by mistake.
Well,
but just to help hide it.
I haven't ever proven that there was an erroneous filing, but. The thing about the land records, right, is that they are so complicated and painful. I mean, the average person would have a hard time understanding exactly what it is and how you find it. So in the latest research, for example, where we're tracking the severing of mineral rights from under properties, some places you file a mineral deed. And when you file a mineral deed, right, you can follow the trail because you know what document. But sometimes it's buried in a quitclaim deed or a special warranty deed or whatever, right? So it is painstaking, and it is a way to obscure a trail should you want to misfile it. And in some cases we found they never filed it, right? They did it in misleading ways. They put the mineral interest in the name of the wife of the CEO. We've seen that. So.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got about 10 minutes, a little under 10 minutes left. Michael, do you have something?
Hi, I'm Michael Walker from Chicago Tribune. Two things. I really interested in stuff. Could you give everybody a little bit of a sense of scale in terms of how long it took people to find those little candy tidbits that went down that string of reporting?
Yes.
And secondly, is there any sign of any of these characters somehow coming back?
Yeah. I found the first $500 million loan for that became the core of the first story on February 18th, 2012. We published April 18th. So it was a two-month turnaround, which I don't think is bad, actually. And most of that was spent, well, the last month was spent tangling with the company. The first month was spent getting independent opinions from academics, SEC attorneys, and others about what this meant. In other words, we didn't presume that this was material. We didn't presume that they had not provided sufficient disclosure. We got independent opinion across all of that before we wrote, and then we asked the company. The company wanted to know who all of our experts were so they could dispute their opinions, etc.
How many people were
that was just me and a partner and a driver. But then for the seven stories, there were five of us. And that series lasted from February 18th, roughly. We actually started at the beginning of the year on the research, to December. It was the whole year. Aubrey's back, to answer your second question. He has a new company called American Energy Partners, and he is doing deals in the Utica right now with a local company and in the Eagleford.
And remind us where those are for the regional folks who might be elsewhere.
Sorry, Utica is in Ohio. That's where Aubrey said this is the biggest thing to hit the state since the plow.
Pennsylvania too, by the way.
Yes, you're right. You're right. And then Eagleford is in Texas. And then some of the other characters. Well, actually, what happened was Aubrey took all of that white senior management team, pretty much, from Chesapeake that was wiped out by the shareholders and moved them to the new company. And that new company, by the way, it's a great story by itself, is less than a mile down the street, and he's put up giant billboards around the Chesapeake campus saying that American Energy Partners is hiring. It's great.
And is he going to return your phone calls now?
I highly doubt it.
Before we move on, a couple questions over here, and then Bernardo had one here. Remind us the author and name of that book again.
Greg Zuckerman is a finance reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Very good. And the book is called The Frackers.
And in your estimation, it will be better than the Matt Damon movie?
Oh, but I saw the Matt Damon movie, man.
Mr. Reddy.
I don't know. I do.
Yeah.
So he got access to these guys.
Yeah.
And they're telling their sort of rags to riches story in their own words, as I understand it. There's an Amazon summary out there.
Hi, Robert. So was there ever anything illegal here? I mean,
well, there's ongoing SEC investigation and ongoing Department of Justice investigation, and then state and other stuff. The board exonerated themselves and Aubrey in an internal investigation which they said in the end found no intentional wrongdoing on Aubrey's part. That was their phrase, no intentional wrongdoing. But look, was there anything illegal? I can't say that definitively. Were there consequences? He lost his chairmanship, then he lost his CEO role, the board got wiped out. I mean, one of the interesting things was, right, at the annual meeting in June, after the first three stories had come out, and remember, investors were fed up already. You know, the board had paid $12 million to buy back Aubrey's personal map collection in a previous deal. They'd paid him $114 million in 2008, highest paid CEO in America, at a time when he had tanked the stock 40% because he got a margin call during the financial crisis, and he sold $596 million worth of Chesapeake shares. So they were pissed. But, you know, this was sort of the final straw. And when the shareholders voted for the three directors that were up for re-election in June of last year, none of them got more than 17% of the vote. That was a record. So real consequences.
And just to backtrack, because we're not a nation of Wall Street moguls, a margin call is basically Wall Street saying, show me the money.
He had pledged his company shares for loans. Mm-hmm. And they said, we're cashing in. And so he had to sell to pay off. So again, remember the lavish and leveraged life of Aubrey McClendon and the pawn in the thunder stakes and the wine? He'd done it with just the company stock, too.
Okay, Bernardo, you are next, and then you will be next after that, and then we'll be close to out of time, so let's keep questions and answers as quick as possible so we can accommodate you.
Mine is very quick. It's Brown Moth, Regard College. Based on the resources, they're not just people with resources, your time, how would a smaller newspaper, a smaller organization, they follow up in stories like that?
Oh, I think there are so many opportunities for local variants of the types of things we did.
Yeah,
for a Post, actually, ID'd one of the mortgages in a March 28, 2012 story.
Yes.
So 2 weeks before my story.
That's what I was telling you.
They ID'd one in...
Business reporter, Eric Schwartzel.
But there wasn't an amount, and I think there was a guy in the story saying, this is fine. It's normal.
Yeah. Eric was really good in getting that stuff, but didn't really put it in context, and I don't think they carried through with the kind of stuff that you guys did. But, yeah. Eric's no longer with the paper, not because he did anything wrong, but because he got a better job with Who's he working for? He's working in Hollywood as a Hollywood reporter now, like covering the stars. Going from business to Hollywood.
So Don, one of the two dominant papers in the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is now sometimes called Fraxylvania because so much is going on there. How much resource does your paper put on it? Is it you, or are you in a business porter, a reporter, or what?
That's really interesting. Before Marcella Shale started, I came back from a fellowship, and my editors told me that I might not be covering environment full time. That I'd have to do general assignment and maybe catch some environmental stories along the way. That was back in 2005. Shortly thereafter, we started to see Marcella Shale activities, and they haven't stopped, and they've never asked me to do any other stories again other than environmental stories. I cover I'd spend 60 to 75% of my time probably is on Marcella Shale. We also have a health reporter that does occasional Marcella Shale stories. We have an energy reporter and a business reporter that covers energy industry. There is greater interest in it than there ever has been. So it's not particularly well coordinated, quite frankly. It should be better. But we're putting as much resources as I think legitimately we can afford to. We're down probably 150 reporters and editors from 10 years ago. Our staff is at 150, I think, at this point.
I'd say that's terrible, but I'm used to hearing that from a lot of people, unfortunately.
Exactly.
We are up against a hard deadline. I saw at least two hands up. I'm going to have to apologize to you. And the final question will be over here. We need to get to lunch. I'm sure you're hungry. And I believe the president probably has to be there on time, too. So for Don's sake, let's make this the last one, and we'll head over to lunch.
Yeah, so I think you're exactly right, and I would encourage all of you to, again, start thinking about what the land records can help you do in your area. This story called Frack My Crib, that's my hope. I hope that gets in the headline, but I don't know, is all premised on the fact that because of the new drilling technologies, the drilling boom is spreading to corners of the country that have no experience with mineral rights. I don't know if I own my minerals. I live in Georgia. Right. I bet a lot of people in this room wouldn't necessarily know, or your neighbors or your towns. Right. But what is that? Yet savvy entrepreneurs who do know about the value of the oil and gas that might later, be leased to a drilling company are taking advantage of that naivete to an extent. Right. There's some disclosure in the form of deeds, but no open disclosure to get those mineral rights, right? And I think it's a big deal. So one of the other things we're looking at is, when we started examining the severed mineral rights, we started seeing other things in those same documents. So in many of those documents, by the way, they sever the water rights too. And then we started hearing from people that they're severing the wind rights and they're severing the air rights. And they're reserving the communication rights. And we're actually working on another thing that we call severed. Basically how the American property is becoming like a Wall Street CDO by slicing it up to generate new income streams from different assets. And I don't know if we're gonna, where it will go, but I'm fascinated by it. So one of the issues that we're looking at is that for example, in the wind rights area, there's a whole new phenomena where people are severing the wind rights and keeping the rights to the future royalty stream for themselves and then selling the surface. So they don't own the land anymore, but they own the flow of air, the rights to the flow of air above it, right? I mean, it's it's got implications. The other issue on the severed mineral rights that is worth exploring, I think, for everybody. Most tax assessors don't take into account the minerals when they value a property. Thus, a property A with the minerals and a property B without are probably paying the same amount of property tax, even though property B without the minerals is worth less. So this is a big deal. And we actually talked to some oil and gas lawyers, some accounting experts, some real estate experts who said this is going to have ripple effects, especially as mineral rights issues spread to new corners of the country. Texas, Oklahoma, yeah, everybody kind of knows, do I have my minerals or not? But elsewhere, no. Alabama.
A lot of those estate rights issues come on a state-by-state basis. That is, different states have different rules, yep. And you really have to be aware right. of what they are for your state. Many of the states, as he pointed out, that have had a history of drilling have severable rights and have well-established laws, but where they haven't been, where it hasn't been going on, either conventional or unconventional now, they don't really address this in their state and their land laws. And some states are looking at new laws, new legislation to address this, and that might also be a place where the industry would be looking to influence and get the wording that would be very favorable to them.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up there.